News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Here's to Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, here's to your health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Adam Zolotor.
And Dr. Zolotor is a guest host with us this week while Dr. Christy Page is on vacation, and we're really happy to have you here with us, Dr. Zolotor.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And on our show today, we're also going to be talking with Dr. Michael Rosenberg about pharmaceutical research saving lives and money. And I think it'll be a really interesting conversation. But first, Adam, let's talk about our research that matters. And this very first one is an article and commentary in the New England Journal of Medicine about the World Wide Web and the Internet. And this seems like an important conversation because just the other day I had another patient come in and say they had worried about their abdominal pain and the 169 diagnoses they heard about by searching it on the web.
I think this is a fascinating topic for discussion because everybody now has instant access to all kinds of information, and some of that information is good and some of that information is bad. I think we've both had experiences where our patients come to us with really good information, information that's helpful, information that facilitates making a good diagnosis or treatment plan. But we've also had experiences where patients come to us, like your patient the other day, with 169 diagnoses for his abdominal pain.
Well, and they were worried, and they worried long before they came in more than they perhaps should have. And then there's this whole question of when listeners and we see and our family members see information on the internet in print form, they believe it's true. And so in this article, in this commentary, they talk about, you know, the absolute falsity of data that macrobiotic diets cure aggressive lymphoma, that AID can be treated with hyperbaric oxygen, that milk thistle remedies chronic hepatitis, and, you know, these other types of issues. And then really getting into some really interesting things about other things that are internet and how it both benefits but how also it threatens to supplant and take away the physician relationship.
That's right. And I think the question at the end of the commentary was, you know, could patients ever figure out everything that they needed to know and not have a visit with their physician? Can they diagnose themselves and come up with their own treatment plan? And I think at the end of the day, our patients are still going to need us to help interpret the information that's out there so that we can use our experience and training to help put the information that they encounter into perspective.
Yeah, I think this is really a take-home point of this particular commentary in the New England Journal of Medicine. Maybe why they even put it out there is there's this continuing, ever-escalating information, and it's overwhelming not only to our listeners and patients, but it's overwhelming to us as physicians. And yet in the sanctity of the physician-provider relationship, one can have the types of conversations that help sort through all of this so that we don't always worry about the most rare of disease, but yet we can be aware of when rare things are and can make that interplay and help patients and ourselves sort through this.
That's right. So let's move on to the next article in Research That Matters, which is a study from the Annals of Family Medicine, Physician Office versus Retail Clinic, Patient Preferences and Care Seeking for Minor Illnesses.
Yeah, you know, this is interesting. You know, and I began to think as I read this is, you know, how many of our listeners have gone to one of the big Target, Walmart sort of things and gone to one of those sorts of clinics? Have you ever been to one of those?
I've never been to one of those. How about you, Adam?
I haven't either. But, you know, maybe if I was in another city outside of this region and I needed a provider for my child, maybe I would do it.
Yeah, I would certainly consider it.
Well, what's this article tell us a little bit about how those decisions are actually made?
This article looks at various choices that patients can make and what they prefer. It was a telephone survey that asked how important was it to go to a doctor's office versus one of these retail clinics? How important was it that you saw a doctor versus a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant? How important was it that you didn't have to wait for your appointment? How important was cost? If you could save some money, would you prefer to go to one of these retail clinics?
Yeah, and it you know, as expected, people varied whether or not they wanted to go to a retail clinic or their provider based upon, well, how quickly they could be seen. If they had to wait a longer period of time, they were less likely to want to see their doctor for some of these kind of smaller things like a urinary tract infection there, whether or not they might see a physician. They would rather see a physician than maybe see a nurse for some of these conditions. And then also the amount of money.
That's right. I think the two take-homes for me were that patients did prefer to see their doctor or a doctor at their doctor's office, but we have to be able to see them soon and we have to have hours to accommodate their needs. But on the other hand, patients also do want to save money, and it looks like if all else is equal, patients would need to save about $31 to go to one of these retail clinics, and that might be on target with the price point in the marketplace right now.
Yeah, and one of the concerns that I would have is just as in many other things, when the large retail giants undercut the local pharmacist by making $4 prescriptions. Patients love it, but it drives out competition. So I would worry that they could potentially drive out the private practitioner in that relationship. I don't know if this is true or happening, but it's a concern I have because they could undercut and subsidize this for a long time.
I think that's right. And the other concern that I have is I think it's important to keep an eye on quality when, you know, healthcare isn't fast food. And so we need to make sure that patients are getting what they need in whatever setting they choose to get their care.
Well, speaking of quality, our next research that matters is really, again, about preferences and how would women and ultimately men prefer to be screened for sexually transmitted infections? Would they prefer to do this at home or to come into the doctor's office?
That's right. I thought this was a fascinating study, and they took women that were enrolled in a contraceptive program and asked them by phone if they wanted to be screened for sexually transmitted diseases at home with self-collection or if they wanted to come into a clinic. They were actually randomized to be given that choice. And overwhelmingly, women preferred to be screened at home. And not only did they express that they preferred to be screened at home, but they were much more likely to get screened if they were randomized to that option.
Yep. 75% of those were most likely to choose to be screened at home than at the clinic, which is only 16%, or on their own medical provider, 8.2%. And of the women who completed the screening, those who chose the home-based testing were more likely to actually complete the test. So not only did they want to do it, they actually followed through with it almost twice as often. This is, I think, highly significant.
Yeah, I think this is a really important study. I think, you know, if we were to replicate this kind of program, it'd be really important to make sure that patients were getting information, education, treatment, and the kind of follow-up that they needed if they had positive tests. But I think this is a really promising way for increasing screening for this really important disease.
Yeah, it's convenient. It's not intrusive. And one of the interesting things I found, Adam, about this is that these women actually preferred to see a different provider than their own physician, it looked like. And I wondered if there's some social stigmata about worrying about this, and that so the more private it is, the more likely you are to do it,
yeah,
which is an interesting thing to be aware of.
That may be so.
What about our very last research that matters?
The next study that we're going to talk about today is about stopping randomized trials early for benefit and estimation of treatment effects.
Oh, wait a second. You're going to have to translate that into some more common language
right.
for us.
So this
now.
Was published in JAMA. And
Journal of American Medical Association. Big study, big journal.
And what they looked at is if a study is stopped early because either it looks like it has a great effect or because it looks like it has a bad effect, is it likely to misrepresent the treatment effect?
Because we typically think, oh, you have a study that's going to last 3 years, we enroll this amount of people, and then we get the answer. But increasingly, if they start to see this beneficial effect, they'll say, oh, we should stop it soon. It's not ethical to keep it going. But this research looks at this differently. What do they do?
That's right. They compare the studies that were stopped early to similar randomized control trials of similar quality that asked exactly the same question. And then they did what's called a meta-analysis where they pooled the data from all of the similar studies, and they compared all the data from similar studies to those studies that were stopped early and found that, in fact, more than half the time, the pooled results of all the similar trials found no treatment effect, and probably the studies didn't need to stop early in many
cases.
So that
if you're doing the study and it's showing an effect, that may be in part an exaggerated effect or even a potentially a false effect, even though it's showing the benefit early. And this argues perhaps against stopping studies early, which is the prevailing way that people are thinking about everything now.
That's right.
Yeah, which will be very, very interesting to think about and talk about further. So
And that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Michael Rosenberg about pharmaceutical research.
Here's to your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Adam Solitar. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about pharmaceutical research, saving lives, and saving money. And this is a topic that I think we read about in the news, Adam, so much about the cost of the pharmaceuticals and the – but what we don't really talk about is really the development of new drugs and the cost and the ways that those are happening in the United States and around the world and what is really happening out there to change that whole structure.
That's right. I think we need to understand better how much it costs to bring drugs to market. And if we're going to continue to excel in new discoveries, we need to be able to either curtail those costs or afford the high price of drugs.
Well, and I think we're really fortunate today to have Dr. Michael Rosenberg as our guest today to help us understand better, which I think is really kind of underneath a lot of some of the discussions in healthcare reform, which kind of at the patient side, but it really didn't really get up to the side of what we're doing and what's happening out there that really is saving lives. Dr. Rosenberg is the president and CEO of Health Decisions, a clinical research company based in Chapel Hill, and he's the author of a new book, which we've been able to read, called The Agile Approach to Adaptive Research, Optimizing Efficiency in Clinical Development. Dr. Rosenberg has written more than 200 scientific articles and has been involved with strategic design and pharmaceutical development for more than 25 years. He's also a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology and an adjunct professor of epidemiology at UNC and the UNC School of Medicine. He received his undergraduate and medical degrees from the University of California and a master's degree in epidemiology and biostatistics from Harvard. So it's great to have you here today, Dr. Rosenberg, to talk about which I think is a really fascinating topic.
I appreciate the invitation, and as you know, I think it's a fascinating topic too.
Good. Well, I guess really one of the first questions we would really just want to talk about is a little bit about, you know, how did you go from being a clinician practicing clinical medicine to moving into research in public health and then ultimately into the type of business that you currently run and operate?
Well, I've always been primarily a researcher. So when I finished my training in internal medicine, I got a master's degree in public health, as you mentioned. And from there, I spent 5 years with the Centers for Disease Control. I've been fortunate enough to be able to do a variety of research all over the world. But one of the things that has particularly interested me, especially in working throughout the world, is how to improve the efficiency of research. In other words, this is a very complex process and basically it involves collecting a lot of data, analyzing it, seeing what that means. How do we make that go faster in order to get better drugs out to the market more quickly and to make them more affordable?
Well, I don't think the public probably has a great idea or even listeners. Give us a sense of a typical drug trial that would influence the way people live their lives. How long does that sort of study take and why does it take so long?
And how much does it cost?
Good question. So let me back up a step and talk about the drug development process because, of course, the development process starts with very small studies. It progresses through larger studies to what are called pivotal studies. These are the very large studies that are usually done with a comparator, whether it's a placebo or a marketed drug. And it's on the basis of that that a drug company would take their drug to the FDA and say, see, it works, it's safe, please allow us to market that. So each of these, they're called phases that the product goes through, takes varying amount of time. The first, the smaller studies are usually focused on safety. Often they're done in normal volunteers. And from that point forward, the second usual piece is deciding what dose to use. And then once you have that set, we go into these very large-scale pivotal studies. So all told, this process of clinical development takes about 7 years.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a long time, but the cost of this is even, I think, more impressive, and that is the full cost to develop a drug today costs about $1.2 billion. So that includes both the direct costs of the drug itself, but it also includes the failures along the way. And unfortunately, we do have a fairly high mortality rate on drugs that go into the pipeline.
So well, give us an example. I mean, how many failures – to get a successful drug to the marketplace, and successful meaning both economically successful but also saving people's lives or improving their health. I assume those go hand in hand, but we would hope. But how many unsuccessful drugs are likely to be there before a successful drug works?
Well, of every 20 drugs that go into the clinical testing, that is, you know, there's a preclinical done in animal, but of every 20 that enter clinical testing in men and women, only about one actually makes it to the marketplace.
And I'm sure there's just a staggering number of compounds that are in the preclinical phase as well to get to that one drug. I think that's really the cost, though, is staggering, $1.2 billion. When we think about how important it is for pharmaceutical companies to be viable, they have to recoup that money on some level to be profitable.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that gives you some appreciation for why drugs cost so much. I think the interesting implication of this is when you think about our ability to develop drugs for smaller and smaller target markets, culminating with personalized medicine, an N of one, you have to think about how inefficient we are at developing drugs today and how basically, to be very blunt, the current model will not allow us to effectively get to the point of being able to develop drugs for very small markets.
Well, you're getting into what I know is in the really kind of the heart of your book, this the agile approach to adaptive research, which is a title that doesn't necessarily give – full justice, I think, to the really important things that you bring out, which to start with, I assume that you believe that a $1.2 billion to develop one new drug is not the way to go for the future. That's too much money. Is that fair?
That's entirely fair. And of course, that's the reason I wrote the book. The reason that I started the company Health Decisions, and this goes back 21 years, is basically as a vehicle to see if we couldn't improve the drug development process. I do believe that as an industry, we've grown fairly complacent. And I know through a number of processes, a number of technology tools and a number of other pieces that we've developed as well as other people in the industry that it is certainly possible to do much better than we do right now. And by possible, I mean anywhere from 25% to 40% faster and less costly.
I mean impressive. And I guess it just raises the question, well, why aren't we doing it? I mean, you know, if you tell me that that's true, and I have no reason to believe it's not because I know you and I know you're spending your life and career, you know, doing this, why aren't we at that place today? What's stopping it?
I think the simple word is inertia. It's also important to keep in mind that this is an industry which has been able to grow and at least arguably to this point has been more or less able to set drug prices on its own. So I think that has led to some degree of complacency. It's interesting that we've seen the other – a degree of similar complacency in other industries that have fared poorly. I think the best example is the automobile industry. General Motors, which was once the largest car company in the world, is bankrupt.
That's a really interesting comparison.
And the people – you know, with the auto industry, I guess the implication here is that you developed a product that you thought you could continuously provide at the cost, and you had others come in other countries that could undercut and produce a better product at a lower cost. And is the rationale here that you can no longer just create a drug for $1.5 billion and then charge X amount more to recoup the cost, that the cost pressures are going to decline, so you've got to be able to produce drugs more cheaper and more efficiently?
Absolutely. I mean, the clearest way of saying it is that we have got to get better at this than we currently
are. So give us some ideas, because we're going to need to take a break, but give us the broad categories. You know, what's the picture look like? And then after we come back from a break, maybe we can get in there. But what are the major areas that you believe and your work shows we can do better with?
Well, the fundamental piece is being able to use technology to make sooner, earlier decisions about a number of different processes that are central to the efficiency of drug development, of studies we do and of the whole process. So I'll just give you a quick example. You know, when we're trying to decide on a drug dosing, we normally start with several doses of that. We run that to the end of the study and then we unwrap the study, as it were, and we see which ones work and which ones don't. With newer techniques, though, we can monitor the progress of each of these dosing arms. And during the course of that study, at some point we can say, this isn't working as well as the others. We're going to cut it off. And that does a number of things apart from the obvious efficiency issue. I think the most important one is that it helps protect the interests of the patients themselves. When something isn't working as well, either because it's less efficacious or it's less safe or either of those, we will know that earlier and we will be able to stop giving that drug to people.
Okay, we need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Michael Rosenberg, about pharmaceutical research. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. Stay with us.
Here's to Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You've been listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health, and we've been talking with our guest today, Dr. Michael Rosenberg, about his new book, The Agile Approach to Adaptive Research. And I should just mention that a couple of the those who've reviewed the book have actually some really interesting things about it. And I don't know if I assume, Dr. Rosenberg, that you may have seen this, but I found it very interesting. They talk about the deepening crisis in the pharmaceutical industry, the inefficiency in the core business, and talking about how you're bringing through real-world cases and examples a better way to understand how drug development can be done and really this adaptive way of approaching this. And you'd begun right before the break to talk about the adaptation in one form of this drug development, but I know you have some other examples of ways in which you and your company are conducting clinical research that really may improve the efficiency and save money and then ultimately maybe save lives. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I think you've hit the issue squarely on the head. I think, you know, the question is always how we are able to make decisions earlier in the process and thereby save time and money. But and we have to balance that against ensuring the accuracy of those decisions. So I think the advent of a lot of technology has changed the way the industry is beginning to work, and I think it'll have a much more profound change. The most fundamental change has been to make sure that when something happens out in the field, we can get that very quickly. Just as an example of that, we use a digital pen to collect a lot of information from our sites around the world. And when somebody fills out a form in, say, Paris, it means that they would ask you a question. They would write that down. After they're done with that, they dock the pen. We have a copy of the form for that. That information is automatically read into the database, and I can put that information on your desktop very quickly. Now, if we back up a second and think about what the implications of having that immediate data are, they're actually fairly profound. There are a couple of things that are important in particular. For me, the most important element is how we run studies on a day-to-day basis. This is a very big change from the way we used to do it, where that site in Paris, for example, would be going on and on. We wouldn't know whether they were doing something wrong. I'll give you an example of this. There was a small company out in Palo Alto that recently had a study fail. This was their main study they used to go seek registration. They looked at the data and they found one site that was performing poorly. And they went to the FDA and they said, look, this site did really badly. We're going to take this site out. When you take the site out, their data looked much better. In fact, it was sort of approvable. It hit that magic 0.05 level. And they went to the FDA and said, how about if we – could you approve this? The FDA predictably said no. But the point is that with the newer technology, if you have a site that's performing poorly, we can know about that and we correct
that immediately. And performing poorly, what do you mean by that? That's not just that they're not getting the results you want.
No, absolutely not. No, by performing poorly, they're actually much more basic pieces. I'll give you another example. 85% of studies in this industry are performed late. That means we set a target date and 85% of those enroll after that time. Now, the problem with
it's more expensive and
– well, that's the main driver of study cost and timelines. It means that instead of something taking a year that we've scheduled –
I mean, I know for our family practice center, we are great at enrolling patients because we're all aggressive about it, and we enroll 2 to 3 times more than typical sites our size. But I don't know if those who are running them have any idea of how good we are at doing that.
Well, I can tell you how your site would look if you were running through Health Decisions. First thing we would do is figure out what you're doing that other sites aren't doing. The second thing we would do is make sure that all the other sites know
I can tell
about
you it's
that.
Our nurses. I can tell you that our nurses are really good about it. They're invested in it.
Well, no, that's really good. And what we would then try to do is figure out what it is about those nurses that we need to be able to clone. Now, you know, management, especially of a lot of complex studies, is not that simple. But what you need is a systematic way of figuring out what's working and what's not working. And for something as central as enrollment, you know, this is everybody's frustration. I don't think there's anybody who works in this industry doesn't express a great deal of frustration over the issue. But the fact is that right now, apart from our systems, I don't know of any other in the industry that gives you this continuous feedback from the field about what's working, what's not working. You know, another example about enrollment is simply if you know where patients are coming from, you know which in recruitment efforts are successful and which aren't, you can go ahead and focus on those. And I'll give you another quick example. I was running a study for sexually transmitted diseases. One of our sites started enrolling like gangbusters right out of the blocks. And of course, we called them to see what they were doing. And they said, we're putting notices on nightclub bathroom walls. Now, I've been doing STD research a long time. Never would have occurred to me. But what we were then able to do is take that, share that practice with the other sites, and we probably cut maybe a month off that study, not a huge amount, but there are a lot of little things that add up.
So certainly there's a lot that can cut study time when we look at enrollment and efficiency. But I'd like to hear a little bit about your thoughts on setting target enrollments midstream in a study, because that's something that you talk quite a bit in your book about, maybe making studies smaller or larger depending on what we're finding in early data.
That's another great point. You know, when we do these very large, very expensive pivotal studies, we always wrestle with the issue of how large they should be, because right now the way we do these things, we set a course basically. We get to the end of the study and, as I said before, you then look at the results and you get either a thumbs up or thumbs down. Now, as you well know, getting a thumbs down is disastrous. You know, if you have a small company and you have one lead product, you can count on your stock price dropping by about 85% in a single day. And, of course, that's predictable. But, you know, if I sit back and think about that, I think, why would you want to undergo that risk? So what you can do as a difference in a different approach is simply make initial an estimate. And then when you're midway through, you check and see how the drug is doing. And if it's doing differently than you based your initial planning assumptions, then what you can then do is adjust that sample size. It's like moving the goalposts to make sure you don't come fall short. But at the same time, it's making sure you don't go too far beyond them either. And
well,
again,
you know, I want to ask the large cow that's sitting in the room here, which is, okay, this has the implication to save money. Clearly, you can shorten the time, you can do these adaptive things, you can help these small companies succeed. But is that it's not only just about saving money and having better business models? You have a great example in the book of how some of the work you've done has actually saved lives. Can you just mention that briefly? Because I know we'll be running out of time about the breast cancer and
Sure. You know, we did a major study of a breast cancer drug. This is it's actually a very interesting drug because it took the place of a very widely used oncology agent. This is a refinement of that drug. So the questions were exactly the same going into this pivotal study. You know, the sponsor thought the drug would work great. We've seen it not work very well a lot of times. So we designed the study to be adaptive on several levels. One is we built in the sample size reassessment that we just talked about. But the other part is that we applied these same adaptive principles to enrollment and a number of other operational—
including analysis and other ways?
That's exactly right. So and what we did with the study is ended up getting it to market a year ahead of schedule. And we did that primarily through two important pieces. The first is a sample size reassessment, and turns out the sponsor was exactly right. The drug did work very well. Much better than we had initially planned, and that allowed us to cut about 9 months off the study. But the other was that this was the fastest enrolling, in this case, a metastatic breast cancer study that we could find evidence of in the literature. And that cut about 3 months off the original study timeline as well. So the total was about a year. This drug did about $366 million worth of business its first year. I don't know how many women that translates to, but assuming this is a more effective drug, then that had a pretty profound effect.
Wow.
That's great.
Well, I know we're going to probably need to wrap up here, but we've been talking with Dr. Michael Rosenberg about the agile approach to adaptive research. And I think what one of the another reviewer said that that the pharmaceutical industry is really at a tipping point today, and it's going to survive or collapse on cost and time and drug research and development. And I think this book is a great attempt to really help all of us understand the sorts of things that need to occur to make sure that it doesn't collapse but it survives and prospers to at least produce drugs that benefit and continue to benefit people. So thank you so much for both writing it and being our guest.
Yeah, thank you for being our guest. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine. Here's to your health.
Here's to your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. For House Calls today on our show, we're going to talk about your questions and experiences and attitudes. And you can also write to us with your own questions, and we'll try to read them on an upcoming show, give you our thoughts and opinions, and you can email them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
We'd like to ask our executive producer, Julie Steiner, to read us some of the questions we have today.
Our first listener writes, I am 51 years old, and I've noticed that sometimes I forget what I'm trying to say. It usually happens right before I start to say something. The forgetting doesn't happen all the time, but it happens often enough that I worry something is wrong. I know it can happen more when I'm worried or tired, but I wonder if something else could be going on too.
Good question. Yeah, that's a... Has that ever happened to you, Adam?
Yeah, it actually happened to me on the last segment of the show, Adam.
Yeah, I think sometimes when we're trying – first off, if we're under some pressure or stress or time or we have several thoughts in our mind, I mean, so part of this is something that happens naturally to a lot of people. But I think maybe there's something else here that this listener's worried
about.
Sure.
I think the thing that I respond to most in the listener's question is that he or she perceives that it might be a change. And I think that this kind of – loss of your train of thought or word-finding difficulty can be typical of age-related memory change and isn't necessarily abnormal for a 51-year-old. But it really depends on how much difficulty he or she's having, how often it's happening, and how much this is impairing him or her in life and in work and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think you're right because, the age-related changes are kind of minor and they don't usually worsen over time versus – if, for instance, our listener is worried that they may have Alzheimer's, which a lot of people are worried about, the earlier signs of Alzheimer's disease are really not this, but they're things like confusion, some difficulty with language, some difficulty with reasoning, getting lost, completing tasks like paying your bills. And those are really kind of a different and more severe. So I think probably this is maybe some stress. Maybe some fatigue, and those things are natural that all of us are going to go through.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think my bottom line here is if the listener has found a change and is having some difficulty with this, it might be time to see his or her physician and get this checked out.
That sounds appropriate. Julie, what's our very next house call?
What is the protocol for patients coming to the doctor late? How long is it okay to come in and expect to still be seen? I asked this because I came in 15 minutes late recently, and my doctor said I needed to reschedule. This seemed odd because I have waited more than 15 minutes to be seen almost every time I have come to the doctor. Couldn't the doctor wait for me once?
Woo!
That's a great question.
Oh, wow. Well, I guess the protocol for coming to the doctor's late is it probably varies.
Yeah, I think it just depends on your office and how it's set up. I think it's
and
really,
the doctor.
And the doctor,
and the doctor,
sure.
too, because, I mean,
sure.
What's our policy in the UNC Family Medicine? Do you know?
I don't know if we should advertise this, but what I'm told is that we'll see patients that are up to 20 minutes late. If they're more than 20 minutes late, then the front desk staff has to have the nurse speak to the doctor, and the doctor has to approve seeing the patient late.
Yeah, and that's to me seems a reasonable policy because it also takes into account the fact that we are sometimes late.
That's
one of the things I tell my patients is if you're running late, why don't you call ahead and let us know, because that way I can choose to see another patient before you and therefore I won't be running behind.
That's right. I think it's really important for the listener to remember that the doctor really doesn't mind seeing you 15 minutes late, but that means he's going to see everybody else 15 minutes more late than he was already running.
And then he's stressed or she's stressed, and that causes that stress to be translated into other sorts of behaviors that may be more difficult for everyone.
Right. We may listen less well. We may not have as much patience for our patients.
But I think in this particular circumstance, it would be reasonable to at least have the conversation and maybe ask to speak to the doctor and explain, again, whether it was really 15 minutes or 20 minutes, whether it was at the end of the day or whether there were three other patients waiting and the doctor didn't feel they could wait anymore. But I think certainly having the conversation – and maybe the doctor never even was involved in this. Maybe it went through the staff. And so I think we believe you have some valid points here, but probably want to encourage you to talk to your doctor a little bit more.
I think that's right.
Julie, what's our very next house call?
In the new healthcare legislation, it seems that a great deal of the improvements in health will be because people without insurance now have it, and they will presumably be able to go to the doctor. The question I have now is this: are there enough primary care doctors for everyone to have one over the next few years? If not, what are we going to do?
Boy, that's a great question. I think that the question about having enough doctors to see all the patients is important with or without healthcare reform. As the listener points out, we're going to have as many as 32 million more people with insurance. Now, it is important to know that many of those people are seeing doctors. They may be going to community health centers, health departments, and emergency rooms. But now they're going to have insurance, so it's easier to afford seeing those doctors. They may be able to get timely and preventive care.
Assuming the underlying premise of the question is, are there primary care doctors enough to actually see these folks? And I think this is an interesting question. And I know both Adam and I actually were looking at some of the research here, both in North Carolina and nationally. And, you know, nationally it's very interesting because over the last 10 years there actually have been a small increase in the number of primary care physicians, but there's been a much more dramatic increase in physicians' assistants and even nurse practitioners. But that doesn't tell the whole story because it doesn't tell where these providers are located, and there's a geographic problem in that they're not located fully in areas that need them. In addition to which, it doesn't take into account the great increase in the growth of the population, particularly the baby boomers who really need and get a lot more care than normally would happen.
That's right. And they're going to be developing more chronic diseases as they age and require more care. Some research in North Carolina has shown that right now we have about the same number of physicians per people in the state as nationally, but we're expected to develop a shortage of physicians of about 8% by 2020 and about 21% by 2030 if things aren't done to change training trajectories over the next decade or so. And I think as Adam referred to, what may be even more important than that is the regionalization or the discrepancy between urban and rural areas, and particularly certain kinds of providers that are very hard to find in rural places.
Yeah, and the final piece I think it's important to know is that it also is the increase that we're seeing actually in primary care providers is actually not necessarily been all in the U.S. trained providers. A lot of it has been from foreign medical graduates. Actually, the great majority has been from that. And so the change in the mix of primary care is really something that I think all listeners should be concerned about and invested in. So more to be said, and I think we'll be following this out. Julie, what's our very last house call?
My friend has a son that quit talking to most everyone and was recently diagnosed with selective autism. I had never heard of it, and I wondered, what is it, and is it common? Sometimes my child doesn't talk for a day, but it never lasts. When do you get worried?
Well, I wonder if they didn't hear it a little bit incorrectly, but because I don't know about selective autism, but there is selective mutism, and this sounds like that type of case where someone does suddenly quit talking. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, I think that the listener's probably talking about selective mutism, and it's important to know if she has concern about her son, that selective mutism is quite rare, and it describes a condition where a child has an inability to speak in certain situations. So often in more stressful or less familiar settings, they may have difficulty speaking. And it can be quite profound. It's sometimes associated with shyness or certain types of situational fears. It could describe a child who might not be able to speak in a school setting for years, but can speak very normally at home.
Yeah, and if this child was talking normally up until now, one hopefully believes that there aren't some other underlying developmental significant issues. But then if the child suddenly quit talking and quit talking to everyone and in every situation, there could have been something that happened causing this selective mutism. And there needs to be really a team approach to really looking into this, including child psychiatrists and psychologists and primary care, pediatricians.
That's right. And make sure that there's not an underlying brain injury that could be causing this.
Yeah. Well, I think that's going to conclude what we can talk about on House Calls today. But we've been able to talk about selective mutism and protocols for when patients come to the doctor late or they're seen late by doctors.
We also talked about that problem that we so commonly experience, forgetting what we were about to say. And we touched on impending physician shortages in light of healthcare reform.
Well, we want to thank you for joining us today on Here's to Your Health, and we hope we've addressed those things that are important to you. And you can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter.
By going to twitter.com/HTYH or searching for Here's to Your Health.
And we'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. And our producer, Julie Steiner, as well as our guest today, Dr. Michael Rosenberg. On behalf of the UNC Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Adam Zolotar.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Thank you.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Here's to Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website at 1360WCHL.com and click on WCHL On Demand. Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine at News Talk 1360 WCHL.